And we are live. This is Dark Journalist. What a fantastic crowd we have out there in the ideas room already. Of course, tonight I am joined by the lovely Olivia.
Hi, everybody.
And Olivia, they're playing those mind games. Mm-hmm. Lifting the barrier, lifting the veil. So many things, you know, to carry in one week with so many different heavy things going on. And of course, the assassination of Charlie Kirk is right in the center of all that. And you could feel out of this event the kind of heavy divide across things. And you could also feel those deep forces that have been manipulating the situation in America for a number of decades. And they've surfaced at times, at different times. And, you know, one of the things I'm going to try to do tonight, when I was looking at the evidence around the case and what they were presenting on the FBI side, a lot of things did not look good to me, honestly. And so I'm going to wait for more things to come out in relation to that case. I'll mention a few of them tonight. What I want to do tonight in this special report, and we'll go about 90 minutes with you here tonight, is to just give us a larger idea about how that system of manipulation works and how they use assassination as a tool, and how groups operate in the background and very often leave someone dangling on the front lines there to take the blame. And we've seen that script play out over and over again. And, you know, of course, we saw it play out last July with Thomas Matthew Crooks. And one of the big telltale signs from that case, and we'll get into some of that tonight, it was all about how in that case, Crooks was flying a drone over the little area there in Butler where Trump was going to have this big crowd in western Pennsylvania. And there he is a couple hours before flying this drone over the area that he is going to attempt to assassinate President Trump in. And then he will easily get on the roof and the Secret Service will elude him. Now, the Secret Service themselves said that they didn't fly their own drone that day. So Crooks was doing more than the most seasoned, accomplished group in the world for security. And he was able to do it. But somehow the Secret Service didn't get their act together to do it, if you buy that. So the strangeness and absurdity of those things put that story into a very, very strange category of assassination and what we were supposed to be facing. Through a small, slight accident, the person who was on that roof, who may or may not have been Crooks, missed their target by a quarter of an inch, and President Trump was grazed. But we were supposed to be in that season of assassination. And the groups that operate with assassination fall dramatically under the umbrella of the Central Intelligence Agency. They are the best trained. That's where you go for assassinations. And their history of assassination is so well developed and well defined that, you know, when assassination cases come up and the CIA isn't mentioned, it's highly suspect. And what they'll very often do in the media is roll out a major CIA figure to sit there and talk about these things without getting into the CIA's role. Very often it's assumed, well, the CIA, yeah, they used to do those bad things, you know, with assassinations and stuff, but they've reformed. They're great now. And of course, we have heavy evidence that they're engaged in all sorts of assassinations across the planet. They were just in the last couple of years planning the assassination of Julian Assange, a private citizen who was operating a news organization in another country. And that's on the record. And, you know, we had Mike Pompeo, who's the director then, who was planning it out. This is what they do. And this function of assassination needs to be understood for what it is and the tool that it is for the deep state. And the deep state, you know, in this case, is not some anomalous villainous group. It's very, very well defined. On this program, it's been well defined for a very long time. And there's an arc of history from which it came out of. And this is why we study that arc and how that arc lands us here in 2025 up against these types of forces that are looking to split that culture for their own purposes. And of course, very many things that you heard out of this shooting that came up were everyone talking about civil war this and civil war that. You know, that's not a meme of strength, and it is not anything to be moved toward in any kind of social media sense, but it is something very desired by certain powers in that deep state, because they can't seem to get a grasp on what they need to do in terms of holding the electorate for their own purposes. So there's a lot to get into around this. Of course, a really classic example of this was Trudeau in Canada during the whole trucker thing when he was prime minister there. And, you know, his disgraceful comments during the whole COVID op, saying, you know, these people who don't agree with us, they're also misogynists and they're also this and that. And, you know, we don't have any tolerance for them. They take up a lot of space. You know, that's hello, Hitler, Germany, 1934, right? So that's the level that they were on. They were building up toward that, you know, Jacinda and the World Economic Forum and Gates and that whole thing. So that is the wave. This is what's going on in the think tanks. And they tried one major operation around that. And I mean, they've been trying several, but they had a serious one there where they had the populace trapped around this whole thing around the COVID op. So now that they've consolidated certain types of gains there, but also realized the limits of their reach, they are looking into these other areas. And one of the things that we've been pointing out a lot is the idea of threats being used to consolidate emergency powers, because their strength is not with the electorate. They don't have enough of those votes to govern. So there are big issues for the deep state going forward. And they move through the left, they move through the right, they move through the parties. You're not going to be able to find them by looking at one particular political direction, although at times they come on heavy on one side, in particular on the left recently, but certainly on the right in the past. And you can see moving forward, they're consolidating positions around AI, etc. I'm very fond of the work of Professor Peter Dale Scott, and we've had him on the program many times. He's, you know, Professor Scott's in his 90s, still doing work. He just put out a stunning 28-page overview on the deep state in relation to the Kennedy assassination. And I hope I can be active like that when I'm in my 90s. Extraordinary. He's sharp. And, you know, it's amazing, because when we do interviews and things with him, he's always like, oh, you know, I've forgotten things. I'm not as sharp as I used to be. And I'm like, what were you like before? So this guy really, you know, who's been writing since 1968, okay, coming up on 60 years of his writing. What he was able to do, and he's, you know, this isn't a right-left thing. He was there on the left coast, and he was coming from a decidedly left point of view. But he was able to identify the combination of factors of a group operating in the background around the continuity of government program in relation to emergency powers, and how they would show up over and over again in these deep events in history. And based on his research, I went off and studied those deep events. I mean, I've been reading Professor Scott probably since I was about 15. But what it did was it opened a door for me to understand why these things interlaced with each other. And if you looked at certain deep events through history in American history, looking at the American deep state, and, you know, trust me, this is a global phenomena, but you would see at times the same personnel. And then if it wasn't the same personnel, what Scott noticed was that many of these people were coming out of this emergency apparatus. And very often their roles in that apparatus were very, very secret. And so when we came across ideas, very deep ideas around the secret space program, and government secrecy around aerospace projects, exotic technology, UFOs, and things of this nature. I started to connect in my own mind all of the emergency COG measures and how they could connect if they had just flipped those things from underground into space. And I'll tell you, it hooked up such a system of ideas that, many of the podcasts and things, and the PopClick world out there is still catching up with a lot of the things that we've been able to present on this program with a number of phenomenal guests and fellow researchers. So, but what it tells us is this, that there is a separate system, a separate operating structure side by side with the normal governance, law and order system, you know, vote for your candidate, all that stuff that we see in the public side. And that covert operation is moving. And at times, what it does when it needs a policy change is it steps into the public arena, causes a deep event, and from that deep event, they get to reshuffle the personnel who are in charge, and they move the direction of the country in one direction that it wasn't going in. Now, it's very interesting because President Kennedy, in one of his final speeches, made note of this and said that somewhere along the line, under the banner of an announced need for more security, they will then take away, you know, an X amount of liberties, speech, and all the rest of it. And he said, even now, it is really pointless for a nation to survive if its traditions do not survive with it. Of course, America is not just a land, it's an understanding, a place. Under a constitution. And we got to a place like this because we were fighting off the tyrannical forces of the King of England, King George at the time, who in an effort, because the colonists were doing so well on their own without his help, and he was extracting all these things from them, and they at a certain point said, no, no, enough is enough. He started to do his own false flags against his own ships, blowing up his own stuff to be like, oh, those colonists are out of control. Quick, send it, some people over there to stop them from blowing up our ships. That pattern from the Revolutionary War kept coming up through history, you know, through the Civil War, through the First World War with the assassination of Franz Ferdinand. And when you see how these things trigger off the wars, and you see that there are groups and societies and secret societies operating in the background to give us this the realities that we go into, what happens is from the First World War to the Second World War and into the Cold War, you know, you move through these various things, Vietnam, the Iraq War, and somebody in that structure, that group in that structure, is laying out and benefiting from this while the public suffers and people around the world suffer. The Ukraine War, for example, is a classic example. But how does assassination figure into all this? And how do you accomplish it undercover? And how do you accomplish fantastic assassination removal of different people who are moving the culture in a totally different direction, and then yourself remain scot-free and above the law? Certainly the mind control aspect is important. The control of the media is important. And the exercise of identification, which is something I want to get into tonight, and this is what you have so much in the current society, is this over-identification with one aspect of cultural development. And people who think they're gaining rights over here in one direction, and then saying to those people, aha, this person is cutting off your rights. They're a Nazi because they don't believe the same things that you do. And you put in place the building blocks for the environment. And then finally, you produce the patsies and, you know, you accomplish the real thing over here. And, you know, it's very interesting. When I was putting this together tonight, I was thinking a lot about the with what was going on. I went back in my mind to all the research I had done around the John Lennon assassination. And people when you look at this, you have to understand Lenin is a very political figure. And although he's back there, you know, talking about 40 years ago when he was assassinated, and if you go into the Kennedy assassination, which has really shaped our modern world and all the research we've done on that, you know, these things go back decades before I was born. But I understand this, that the echo and the shadow of these things stalk the country, stalk the world, and it grows. And it grows to a point of the defense contractors and the ultra wealthy and these groups consolidating. And that's where that deep state understanding becomes so, so important. So in the back of my mind was all of the study I had done on the work of the Russian philosopher Gurdjieff, and some of his teachings, I think, around identification become very, very important to understand the kind of social brainwashing and social conditioning and engineering that we're seeing going on. So we're going to touch on that tonight. I have some very interesting quotes from that and some very interesting information to use as a case point, the Lenin assassination, for us to understand when they take out a very powerful figure like Kirk was, and make no mistake that he was making tremendous inroads with the youth of America. Not that if you look at all of his work, you'll agree, you know, depending on where you're at or looking at things, but the tremendous influence that he was having around traditional American values, the traditional biblical values and things of this nature, while they've been using a heavy duty radicalization of the campuses of America as part of a program. And again, from the prosecuting aspects of American legal system to the campuses, there's a major operation going on with figures like Soros and others involved in this. And then rising over here on the other side, we are seeing this tremendous lift of AI and, you know, the ascent of this technology that's been developed in the background, which, by the way, they're very ahead of us on. So we have a lot to really focus on and understand. But I think the social engineering is a particular piece, and we can get so much of it because some of that mind control aspects and the people who were behind it and the patsies that they laid out there have been now years after the fact uncovered. So in a way, like, you know, in the current environment, we can't wait 5 to 10 years to find out, you know, who's behind the types of things that we're seeing moving the society towards civil war. I said this in relation to the UFO hearings from this week, which, you know, they were so terrible. And then all this news just, you know, got rid of that. It had no significance at all. And those people in Congress who are putting these things together, they had an opportunity with the task force. They were tasked with opening up the secrets around the historic JFK assassination, the RFK assassination, and finally the UFO file. And they failed on the JFK assassination to bring forward anything of significance, and except photo ops and things for themselves. And then on the UFO file, you know, they had the same bogus choir there in the background moving out these facts. Now, I want to put this on the record, which is, you know, we talk about a lot of deep things here on the Dark Journalist Show. I make a great emphasis on the UFO file, and the reason is that it represents a deep major technology that is held secret. And so that helps to fuel this secret development over here. That includes personnel, development, finances, black budget, and all the rest of it. So whether you're talking about covert wars over here, covert development over here, this aspect around the UFO file is important, and it has to be understood in that larger context when we talk about intelligence agency. The very same groups that are arranging these social classes and the real battle that we're looking at, they're also behind the hiding of this technology and then the misdirection that's involved with the technology. So, you know, using it for their own purposes, creating a threat from outer space, you know, creating a menace you know, oh, the 3i Atlas is coming to get you. You know, the government needs to get a $1 billion 3i Atlas defense system going, you know. So this is what's going on in the background. And whenever we get into these so-called transparency hearings and things, you're having all these intelligence people come forward, and the latest display was no different than that. What was particularly shocking, before we get into our MK Ultra dive for tonight, and tonight's a tall order for a special report, but we're going to pull it off. But what I think grabbed me when I was watching it was that this Congressman Burleson, a Republican from Missouri, comes forward and he says, oh, I have this film, and it's like nothing you've ever seen, and it shows us firing a Hellfire missile at this unidentified object, and the object absorbs it and keeps on going, and you know, all this stuff. And as you get through that conversation, he presented this in Congress officially. And then when asked, where did you get this? He said, I don't know anything about it. It has no provenance. It was a dead drop. So somebody cooked up this thing in the background to keep that threat thing going and keep a certain group, pop click stuff, happy. But now they brought that into Congress through this figure who did not vet his own video that he presented. It was kind of a, you know, a sick display of, you know, he might as well have been, you know, promoting an entire hoax, because there's no background to it at all. Zip. So I thought it was extraordinary, and I went through and looked for interviews of him beyond what he said there. And in all of these different interviews, he said, well, I want to say right off the bat, I don't know anything about this video. Well, then why are you showing it before Congress? And why are you saying, you know, all these different news outlets are picking it up and saying whistleblower video? So that's not a whistleblower video. It is a product of the intelligence agency. And this guy doesn't have to say anything, since it's anonymous, doesn't mean anything. If it turns out to be entirely bogus, well, I guess he's not to blame, right? Because he said, hey, I don't know anything about it. And yet he presented it. So this is the type of bogus atmosphere that you're in. And I want to point something out about what I've pointed out about the forces in the DOD that are putting forward this threat operation. That, in fact, the same people, Chris Mellon and others, who gave us these, you know, tic-tac videos and all this other stuff, those were also supposedly anonymous smuggled out videos. But guess who took responsibility for them? Well, don't believe me. I'm going to read it right from the article here. Hold on. Very interesting indeed. Ex-Intel official says he was the source of the Pentagon's UFO video. Well, I wonder which ex-official it was who gave us the Tic Tac and all those other special dead drop videos. Well, it was Chris Mellon. He's the ex-Intel official who said, yeah, I'm the one who got those videos out. So guess where Burleson's video came out that was a dead drop that nobody knows anything about? It came directly from Mellon. There's no doubt in my mind. He dropped it on Burleson. Burleson laid it on the public. You get no closer to the actual subject matter. This is the nature of the problem with those hearings. And we're going to explore it tonight in that larger context of the mental manipulation. So you have the individual kind of MKUltra program creating patsies and things of this nature. Then you have the larger brainwashing of the social engineering for the public. That has to be our leap-off point, and then confronting what the assassination program is all about. We'll do all that for you tonight in our special report. This is our Deep State Assassination MKUltra revealed special for you. And before we started tonight, of course, Erica Kirk came out and gave a powerful statement. You heard the whole thing, right? And what did you think of that?
I read the whole thing about what?
Oh, no, Erica Kirk's statement.
Yeah. She's a remarkable woman.
Incredible, really, right? Incredible strength to come on after that. Just
Well, that's faith for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, she did a great demonstration there of, you know, saying we're going to go forward and do this. I do think that in the you know, cultural war context and the ramping up of, you know, rhetoric and assassination tactics from the deep state and things, you you have got to be about your wits if you're in that political arena right now. And all of those people should amp up their security dramatically, because I can tell you one thing I know about the agency from my own study of it is they work in season. And when they have a season of assassination going on, watch out, because then, you know, you have them, you have this pattern rolling out. And I don't say that to, you know, be a fearmonger or anything. I'm actually just trying to speak directly to the people involved. If you're doing those outdoor events, if you can't have people securing the roofs, I mean, what's interesting is the amount of times, if you go back and listen to Charlie Kirk talk about the threats that have been made against him and people rushing him in restaurants and things like that. He understood the security threat, and I'm sure he understood it going into that event. So how they were able to weasel this kind of crooks to situation of a guy lying flat on a roof and taking a shot from about 200 feet, which was the same distance,
yards
in the, yeah, that's right, in the crooks situation. And of course, part of the problem here is that we never got the answers in the crooks scenario. That's a very big problem and leaves a huge, huge gap in, you know, public protection of these officials. But by leaving that out, and I think it's a dereliction of duty by the Secret Service, the FBI, and others, the fact that we never got to the bottom of what was actually going on there with Crooks and his confederates, the people who put that person on that roof, we don't really even know if that was Crooks on the building. There were people who were identified earlier, Matthew Yerrick and others. And then the idea that this guy was going to get himself on the roof and elude Secret Service and all that nonsense was exactly that, nonsense. And we had Beverly Sheetal come forward, and she was dismissed as the Secret Service director as a result of that dramatic failure. And there was a weird thing in the air at that time, because they had Biden, who could not think properly, and they were thinking of switching him for Harris after the disastrous debate situation. Then they went for the assassination. So they're very close. They're always teetering on that edge of just plunging us into a totally different scenario. So we have to be kind of, you know, looking at this on a very deep level at a point when something as dramatic as this takes place. But one of the things I think is very important to understand about Sheetal, and again, she's a functionary in all of this, but she was involved in the continuity of government program. In fact, she was the COG agent who dragged Dick Cheney into the COG bunker during 9/11. So there you have your COG tie over, which is for some reason unmistakable, you know, and you could try to say, well, I'm going to look through a number of these events and prove Professor Scott's theory wrong or the research of dark journalists wrong. And you'll just go through them, and the COG people are all around everything from the Kennedy assassination to Watergate to Iran-Contra, you know, to the whole economic crisis in 2008, 9/11, you know, the people who invented the second wing of COG in the 1980s are the people who activated during 9/11. So, and then of course the COVID op, you've got all these people are involved there, and suddenly COG becomes almost like a, you know, a punchline to them, whereas before you couldn't even say continuity of government and Congress. They would stand up, and there's a classic example of this when they had Oliver North in the 1980s, who was funneling money to the Contras in Central America fighting the Nicaraguan Sandinistas, and he was selling the Iranians' missiles and taking the money from that. And he was using the Doomsday Network communication system in order to do this. So this is the radio communications that you would use in the event of World War III. It's ultra secret. It can't be tracked. There's no recordings of it. But North was using it in order to facilitate the sale of these weapons across the world, and then the funneling and the black budget monies, money laundering back to Central America. That program and those people, North, Cheney, Bush, that whole gang, they were all involved in setting up the second version of COG, which was the one that took it out of the context of just surviving a nuclear disaster and moved it into this totally different realm of any disaster. So any threat that comes up, we can activate COG. And in fact, when we got 9/11, that's what they did. They activated it. And you and I in America live under the September 11th emergency. So that COG was activated on September 11th. That's where you got NORTHCOM. And every president from Bush to Obama to Trump, Stepford Biden even, they all have to sign on to that every year with the National Defense Authorization Act. That $1 trillion of funding is attached to the emergency, always. So you're always under emergency powers. The thing is, if they activate the continuity of government program on the level of flipping the switch, then you get a COG commander and the regular structure goes away and they appoint regional governors and all the rest of it. Now, you know, those types of scenarios become more and more obvious, you know, as a possibility with the types of things that get moved. And when you think about how these forces are looking for their own benefit in this situation, how do they get a real advantage? Well, the continuity of government program would really supply that for them, but they need the emergency. That is the ticket to the show. And we're going to talk about how they get to that here in a special episode. I want to remind you, if you're new here especially, to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for our newsletter. That is a free newsletter, but it keeps us in touch through the heavy-duty censorship around the episodes that we do, especially dealing with COG. And it's a pretty simple matter, really, because you sign up for about 30 seconds, and we'll let you know about the incredible, and I mean incredible, documentaries, docuseries we have coming up for you, X-series episodes that will blow your mind, and the phenomenal interviews that become so vital in this period of time. It's all there in the newsletter, and it's free. So take advantage of that and stand up and be counted. Get behind it. I also want to remind you that in the last half hour here of this program, we're going to take your questions, and Miss Olivia is putting those together right now. Before I go any further, Miss Olivia, what do you got?
Scarlet Fire says, public assassination is so primitive, yet still has the ability to change everything on a dime. Karen Carpenter says, is the Charlie Kirk assassination a mass trauma event? And Neo Lemuria says, humanity's egregore is being carefully curated. What are we crescendoing towards?
I say Neil Lemuria. Mm-hmm. That's good. That's a name. I like that one. Yeah, those are all right on. You know, what's interesting is assassination is not understood. It isn't. Very often, the way it's played out in the media is there's some disgruntled person. They laid the template with Oswald. And, you know, he's from some political affiliation. He's disgruntled. He wasn't happy in his life. And what you see them doing a lot now is, you know, they'll be like, oh, this guy was a soy boy, or he was an incel and he wasn't getting along with others. He got radicalized and boom, you know. I don't think that they would trust the type of assassination work that they've accomplished and that they've nearly accomplished to any kind of amateur or somebody who was imbalanced because he wasn't accepted in high school, whatever. Those are good cover stories, and you do find, you know, that profile can be responsible for all kinds of mischief and regular crime studies. So what they do is they amplify this, and they're particularly concerned, I think, with doing this at this point. They're trying to put forward a young profile of somebody who's kind of off balance and young. In fact, when you get, for example, in the situation of who put the person on the roof during the Trump incident, you need tremendous, and I mean tremendous, setup to do something like that. You have to have the security stripping of the Secret Service standing down. You have to have the person being positioned on the roof with the rifle and an escape route, you know, all these different things. And of course, in the case of Crooks, they had seen him up there. And while the president was on stage, they were getting reports of this guy being up there, and they didn't do anything to act. And the idea was, whoever was operating this thing, there was just supposed to be enough time for this guy to get off his shot, which he did. Now, if you look at the historical ramifications of assassination in terms of the Kennedy assassination and Robert Kennedy's assassination, everything that they did through the 1960s, the program continued. This is, you know, there's different types of assassinations. Sometimes they're done with bullets, and sometimes they're done with plane crashes, heart attacks, and all the rest. So it's not a very, you know, fun endeavor to track how they've done that. And yet it's so extraordinarily obvious that there's an active program engaged in that, coming from some source here operating in the deep state. That is a level that they get to. And when they really need to operate that, it can happen on a mass scale. But when they need to redirect and make sure that a person is taken off of this stage, the political stage, you know, in the case of somebody like Kennedy, you know, the fact of his charisma was going to give his brother the presidency after he left it, and they'd be dealing with a dynasty there. So they had a lot of issues going in, I think, with the Kennedys. And the other thing was, they had decided, and this is something I think is important in Professor Scott's work, that he calls it the first deep state revolt against the presidency. They decided at that point, we're moving against the presidency. Before that, they would, you know, go against a senator who was against them, an attorney general, whatever it was. But to actually take on the central role of the presidency with assassination was a change of policy. So the Central Intelligence Agency had grown as a force that, when they became diametrically opposed to the executive branch, they said it's them or us, you know, and that's a change. And if you look at that period of 1963, and how that is really, you know, it's kind of a genesis for the period that we're in now, because, you know, larger population after World War II, more technology, greater economic prosperity and things, it has a lot in common with what we're moving into. So that's kind of like an early genesis moment. And what they did there was, they defined it as, we cannot have an individual selected by the electorate who has policies that are different than what we want to do with the world. And those forces in there would decide on this, and then they would move in various ways, but then they would control the cover-up in the case of the Kennedy assassination ever after. And it was funny, I just have a little aside on this. Sometimes I go into the programs that they used in order to contain that assassination. And I'm going to talk about four different assassinations tonight and how they're related to the MKUltra program. But one of the things that they did was, anyone who was associated with the event who didn't keep to the original story would get rubbed out. And that's where you get those tremendous death lists after the Kennedy assassination, whether it's, you know, the Warren Commission or the House Assassinations Committee, even the ARRB, which happened much later, like 1997, there's a whole death list associated with that. So anything when you got around the Kennedy assassination, you know, for say the 50 years after the fact, anything in there was very tough. But certainly, particularly in the first 5 to 10 years after it, the death lists were off the charts and extraordinary. One of the things I ran across when I was looking at people who were identifying the shooter of Officer Tippit, which is part of how they set up Oswald, and his MKUltra connections, I think, are highly interesting, is... this gets very interesting, but they they had an individual who was a witness who saw this person who was running from the police after he had shot the cop. But the person wouldn't go along and say that he had the same look and the same identity as Oswald. I'm going to read his statement because I find it so interesting and what happened to him. It's a very short little piece here, but I think it's very telling indeed. Before I go into that,
I'm having a technical issue.
Excellent. Guy's name is Harold Russell, and the FBI report was certainly interesting. He advised that upon arriving at the intersection of 10th and Patton, he observed a Dallas uniformed police officer lying on the ground in front of a Dallas police car, and from all indications, the Dallas police officer was apparently dead. Russell advised the police officer's weapon was lying on the front seat of the Dallas police officer's car. That's Officer Tippett there. At this point, an unknown individual stated to Russell, "Let's take the police officer's gun and go get that SOB," this kind of Oswald lookalike who's running away, who is responsible for this. Now, what's interesting to me about that is this person was never identified. And it seems to me, you know, this whole idea that they were going to eliminate Oswald at the theater really resonates very, very well. But so this guy gives his testimony and everything, and they don't like it. They're not very happy with this. And so now, 2 months after the assassination, on January 22nd, 1964, Harold Russell, who's the guy who gave this testimony, even though he agreed that the escaping Tippett killer could have been Oswald, but even this did not save his life. And this comes out of Penn Jones' research. A few months after the assassination, Russell went back to his home near Davis, Oklahoma. On July 23, 1965, Russell, 53, went out of his mind while at a party with friends. It's like a little LSD dosing there. He was crying and telling his friends that he was going to be killed, that he had to be hidden immediately. People at the party called the police. Policeman answered the call. He hit Russell in the head with a pistol, and Russell died a few hours later in a Sulphur, Oklahoma hospital. There's so many occasions around the Kennedy situation. It's like this vortex where they need to control the narrative so much that you can't have one person out of line. And the people involved seem to know that they are targets for this. And I have to say that when you get around the Kennedy assassination, there are all these hints of, deep hints of mental manipulation of the subjects involved. Ruby, you know, the MKUltra doctor, Jolly West, visits him and then has this report, which I'm going to read tonight. Now, Jolly West was one of the top doctors involved in the MKUltra program. So, and he will show up in history over and over again. And it's being pointed out more by researchers now in cases like the Manson case or whatever. Whenever they need somebody to create, this identity and use that MKUltra program to get them to break down or confess, whatever it happens to be. Now, in this period, and I like to point out this movie because I think it tells us a great deal, and it's very interesting to me that Hollywood tried to remake this movie, and they ruined the thrust of what it was trying to do. The movie itself is called The Manchurian Candidate. It was taken off the market for decades, and actually, it was Frank Sinatra who was in it, and who, again, had this incredible back and forth with the Kennedys, being their best friend and then being persona non grata. And that brings in the entertainment aspect here with intelligence. But one of the things that that movie did was it showed how, in this early period, how mind control operated. And so while these soldiers have been drugged and through light induced into this state, while they're sitting surrounded by all these kind of communist assassin characters and generals and things trying to figure out how to assassinate their candidate for president over in America, they're seeing it as a big luncheon with these women doing, you know, flower luncheon and things like that. And so some of the opening, that's even in the opening of the movie, but it goes so deep into showing what we're up against. So one of the things that starts to happen is this person who's been picked out as a hero for the action that has taken place, Raymond Shaw, he is in a major ambush during the Korean action, and he gets all these, you know, medals and things. He comes back home as a hero, and you know, they want to run him for president. Now, he keeps having dreams that instead of doing this heroic action and all this other stuff, that actually he was being held captive and hypnotized and all this stuff. And so he's telling his wife, you know, I keep having these visions of this whole thing. Very interesting to me, too, that if you think about the Betty and Barney Hill encounters, and, you know, I think that's a very important case. But I do want to point out that it is through dreams that they start to have the memory of what has taken place there, meaning somebody had hypnotized them to forget their actual experience. And that's what they were doing in the movie. What happens in the case of the Manchurian candidate is they turn him into an assassin, and they test the programming over and over again for him to, you know, to be sure that the hypnosis will hold and that he can be built as this ultimate assassin. And what he needs to do is he assassinates the president, and then the vice president takes over heroically, holding the dead president in his arms. That's what his job is. And it's up to the Sinatra character to stop him, to find him and to stop him. And so he finds out that he's being controlled by a series of symbols, that ultimately the Queen of Diamonds is the ultimate symbol. Now, it's very interesting. When you go into some of the major assassinations in history, and you're looking at, you know, Jack Ruby assassinating Oswald or Sirhan, the John Lennon assassination in particular is a crack in how we can observe this. But what happens is the mechanism of how they get them into this state has to be accomplished, usually in a hospital. And then they're able to kind of guide their life to a point where they can put them in this position. And then they need these ladders of symbolism in order to bring them into the event. Of course, in the case of the John Lennon assassination, it's the book, The Catcher in the Rye, that is the signal, you know, just very much like the Queen of Diamonds was. That whole program and the people who were around the assassination of Lennon, it's not very well understood. What we understand about the Lennon thing is, you know, the traditional media thing about it was, Lennon was famous. This guy wanted to be famous. He resented Lennon. He killed him. You know, Lennon had been out there for years. He'd been surrounded by millions of fans. He'd always said controversial things and all the rest of it. He'd never been assassinated. He'd never been shot at. So now, you know, do we have people out there who would do those types of things? Absolutely. But there is a kind of security protocol that goes on when somebody's at that level of celebrity or that level of politics. And it's very hard for an average person to get through and do that. However, an agency under the guise of how the public would receive it as, oh, you know, this maniac is on the loose. And, you know, after they catch the guy, you know, and I think we're going to see a lot of this in the Cook case, unfortunately, they already have it ready that this guy wasn't happy with his life and that this guy was radicalized. And, you know, it's very hard at this stage to assess what they're doing there, but you can already see there's a lot of telltale signs right off the bat. And when I look at that case, you know, some of the things that appear odd to me right away is that the guy's in a technical college as an electrician. You know, so Robinson, you know, is that hardly seems like an environment to be radicalized in. So they're going to have a hard time explaining how this takes place. But in any case, I think that we need to look deeper, regardless of how they present these things, because What we can do is use the cases that they've lied about as a template to see where they lied, how they lied, and what the actual truth was, and how MKUltra was involved in nearly every one of those major assassinations that took place over the past 60 years here in America and abroad. You know, we have a particular emphasis on the American ones, but this thing happens all over the world. And that season of assassination I was talking to you about, if you go back and trace these periods, one of the main periods is that 1962 to 1963 period, you will find all over the world leaders being thrown out. And in the Kennedy assassination, the assassination of the Diem brothers who ran Vietnam, they were the leadership corps. And it was the Central Intelligence Agency that decided these guys have to go and removed them by allowing their enemies there in the government to shoot them up and setting it up and luring them into a trap and all that. And that happened 3 weeks before the assassination of our president in America. So this was a pattern. They needed the leadership in Vietnam to change. They needed the American leadership to change. And they wanted the French leadership to change. In fact, they had attempted to overthrow and kill de Gaulle, but he avoided it, and he got the group that were trying to overthrow him in a coup, and he was able to prosecute them and all the rest of it. And then he went to Kennedy and said, "What, you know, who was helping these people on the American side? What's going on here?" And Kennedy said, "The problem is, I don't know. I don't know who was the CIA that was helping them. But, you know, I'm going to get to the bottom of it." But he understood that the Central Intelligence Agency was a runaway criminal organization, and how do you get that back under control? So here we are operating 60 years of this situation, and we're still wondering, how do you get that under control? Maybe some of this next section can give us some idea about how you do that. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. Deep, deep tonight in this special report, which is Deep State Assassinations Revealed and MKUltra as the major tool in the majority of these assassinations for the purposes of social engineering. And we're going to be taking your questions here shortly. And, you know, of course, it's a very tragic week with all the events that have happened with the Kirk assassination. And I can say that the, you know, the things that I've seen, the influences that I've seen around this lead me to believe that they're trying very hard to create that split in America. And that, you know, that isn't the kind of thing to take the bait on, but you can unmask them when the forces that are out there are moving in this way. And we saw in the responses of the media, you know, just a complete disgrace on the way that they handled this, you know, because they were trying to paint Kirk as somebody who was, you know, like, oh, he's like a hate group or something like that, when he's just like maybe ultra traditional, you know, in a biblical sense. It's interesting too, because I grabbed one of these things that they did in the media. You know, they do this a lot now, and they hit you with a particular headline, and that headline is the banner that everyone runs around with, and the retweet and all the rest of it. And then maybe a day later, they change it. They make a correction. They say, oh, we made a mistake. But the damage is done, right? You've already portrayed the image. And I'm going to read you one of those. And yeah, and this is, you know, our old nemesis, the New York Times here, but this is an editor's note. So the name of the story was Where Charlie Kirk Stood on Key Political Issues. And then they say this. Now, in the article, they included information that was false, clearly false. 24 hours later, they come out with this. Correction was made on September 11th, 2025. An earlier version of this article described incorrectly an anti-Semitic statement that Charlie Kirk had made on an episode of his podcast. In fact, he was quoting a statement from a post on a social media and went on to critique it. It was not his own statement. So they attributed it to him because he was reading it off the thing, but he actually was against it. Okay. But for 24 hours, they left the impression that he was anti-Semitic, right? Now, and then there's a note from Matt Taibbi that he's talking about the Times having an grudging and uncharitable correction. The Times described incorrectly an anti-Semitic statement that Charlie Kirk had made, quote unquote, isn't the same as we incorrectly ascribed anti-Semitism to Charlie Kirk. Exactly. That's exactly what the problem is. When you go looking for the statements the paper matches to these extreme words, they turn out to be things like advocating the use of the term China virus and using his platform to decry racial equity programs. The line that struck me said, Kirk believed Jews are trying to replace white Americans with non-white immigrants. So these are the things that they were able to convey about Kirk, so that in fact, you know, people wouldn't look at the fact of the horror of him being assassinated, but would just be like, oh, he was a hate monger and all this kind of stuff, which is completely untrue. Now, I want to point this out. This comes directly out of 1984, and it sums up so, so dramatically. I mean, Orwell was so tuned into what was going to happen in so many ways, Huxley more so. But Orwell nails certain things so, so well because he understood and studied intelligence brainwashing programs. But he talks about a program that they have in 1984 called Crime Stop. And just listen to this, how it plays out, and how it really seems like something that we're dealing with right now. Okay. The first and simplest stage of discipline, which can be taught even to young children, is called in Newspeak, Crime Stop. Crime Stop means the faculty of stopping short, as though by instinct, at the threshold of any dangerous thought. It includes the power of not grasping analogies, of failing to perceive logical errors of misunderstanding. The simplest arguments, if they are inimical to Ingsoc, which is the main cultural branch there, the brain of 1984, and of being bored or repelled by any train of thought which is capable of leading in a heretical direction. Crime stop, in short, means protective stupidity. Protective stupidity. That's exactly what those New York Times articles were rolling out there. My own exposure to mainstream media over the years, and you know, I've been embedded in that system at times. My impressions have always been that the writers themselves operate very, very, very little independent thought. You have a central core coming directly from the publisher and the editor-in-chief, and they tell and they translate that through the writers. So if you are on the deep state side, all you need to do is control those people on the publishing and editorial side, and you get the kind of results that you're looking for. I guess that's clear enough. Okay, I'm going to get into some hypnosis things here having to do with MKUltra and the assassination. The assassin, Mark David Chapman, and some new things that are coming out that may blow that case 40 years later completely out of the water with evidence, which is a very strange thing. Again, there's an echo back there of why would they remove this, you know, entertainer, this popular guy, and it's going to give us a much clearer sense, some of the newer things that are coming out there. We're going to take your questions too shortly. Before I go any further, Miss Olivia, what do you got?
And John Madri says, the writers are agents too. Let us remember.
Yeah, they're kind of like paid monkeys. You know, and, but I, you know, it's definitely, it's coming from the top down, because if you write the wrong thing, you're just out, you get ousted. And, but in this day and age, you really, you know, a lot of those people, there's no real excuse because you can run your own thing. So you don't have to be part of this maniacal media organization that's lying. Second nature is to lie to the public. And the problem is, what's interesting is the lying is so naked. and it's so exposed, you know, at this point with the amount of social media that's available, that it gets stranger and stranger, you know, and MSNBC with this foolishness of this guy coming out and saying, well, Charlie Kirk was shot by a supporter. He may have been shot by a supporter who was celebrating. You know what? They were just insane. That guy had to get fired. Even they, in their incredible, you know, pit of misinformation, even they had to do it. But, you know, you look, there's no real good analysis. There should be deep, deep analysis on the, who's pulling the strings of those major figures. Because, again, they're functionaries in that system. You know, you have someone like Rachel Maddow making $40 million a year. You know, she just needs to keep functioning for them to feed that stuff to a particular contingent of, you know, liberals who have gone from having a liberal point of view to now they're being kind of weaponized. And this is the nature of the problem with where the media has gone with this. And I think it's become worse since the election of Trump because they weren't able to get the results at the ballot box that they wanted, and they're trying to achieve the result through other means. And this is the nature of the problem and why the coverage is so bad. So I think, you know, the best antidote there really is just to not pay attention to them. And the other problem is, though, in general, in life, you know, you're going to have groups like MSNBC and CNN and all that, and they have a powerful reach, you know. Even discredited, they still have a powerful reach, and they know how to whip up their supporters, and they know how to whip up their donors and the Democrat donors and things of this nature. And in fact, you know, the terms like Democrat and Republican now become very, very difficult to reason because, you know, I'll tell you from my own point of view, the Democrats, if you go through that historical, you know, that entire scape of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the Democrats had a lot of important things to say in that period. They had a lot of dynamic figures as well. And what happens is that aspect of the party gets sold out through the Clinton forces. And the Clinton forces are merged with the Bush forces. I forgot to print out this dramatic picture of George Bush visiting with Governor Clinton there in 1985. They're having a gay old time at a picnic, just sitting there drinking beers with Governor Clinton. And they're setting up MENA, Arkansas, you know, the drug drop that they can move all these drugs into the country as part of the supporting the Contras. And that's where you get the crack epidemic and everything else. And of course, the presidency goes from Bush to Clinton. And, you know, they maintain a very, very tight relationship, the Bush forces, the Clinton Foundation. And, you know, the son, of course, W., and all the things that he did with the continuity of government program. But he, you know, all the things that he did in co-sponsorship with the Clintons and then the Obamas. I mean, that whole thing, those people are all merged together as one super system. Trump's the outsider there, you know, and you can view Trump in any way that you want to view him, but he's an outsider to that system. There's no question about it. And he dared to defy them on certain things that were absolutely, you know, sacred cows in that situation. So we're in a dynamic flux of a situation there with the current political system. And, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, you hear all this kind of fear-mongering around Trump and all the rest of it. I'm going to point this out, that the Democrat situation and the Republican situation in Congress now rests on about 3 votes. Okay, so if you switch a half dozen congressional seats, the Republicans lose control in 2026 and the Democrats have it. You know, in the Senate, you've got, again, a couple more, you know, it was a 53-47, something like that. These are not major numbers. Here's the thing. That's a very slim margin to govern by. And so Trump's in there, barely has control of the Congress, barely has the Senate. What you should do if you're the Trump administration is push through the things that you think you can make into law through the Congress and the Senate while you have it. It's nice to write executive orders, but you can write executive orders till you're blue in the face, because it will make some changes now. But then if somebody else gets in there, remember, the first thing he can do is he can sit down and undo in one afternoon all of your executive orders. Laws that get enacted through legislation in Congress are much more difficult to get rid of. In fact, almost impossible. So therefore, I would emphasize that while they hold the Senate and while they hold the Congress, that this administration needs to get a number of those changes on the record. And, there are some tremendous things going on in terms of immigration and really supporting a closed border and a number of other things that are happening on the economic side. So you've seen some dramatic changes, but I think what you need to do is codify the whole thing through Congress, and you can't operate as Mr. Executive Order guy. So that's a little free advice for the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. Everyone, you watch the Dark Journalist Show. Whew. All right. Deep state assassinations revealed. Mark David Chapman and how this situation is unraveling. 40 years ago of this political assassination of an entertainment figure. You understand that they will apply it. Whoever becomes into that political orbit, they'll apply these same types of things to. Doesn't matter if you're talking about an entertainer, an actor, whoever it happens to be, this is what we're dealing with. Okay. Let's start here. So Chapman is an enigma to history. There's no explanation for this guy at all. I'm going to tell you why. Chapman, who grew up in Georgia, he had a job. The job that he held just previous to assassinating Lenin was as a security guard at a hospital. Now, this same hospital that he was working at, they gave him the job, and he had originally been placed into the hospital because he was put in there for depression. And while he was in there for depression, he met an Asian woman, and it's very interesting with his obsession around Lenin. It's almost like they gave him his own kind of Yoko clone handler. And, oddly enough, he fell into this group that was running it who were Seventh-day Adventists. And there's a wonderful book out there, and I'm going to quote from the book before tonight's over. But David Whelan is the author, and he was a television producer in England who went into some of the very strange anomalies in the Kennedy and the Lenin assassination. Now, he was able to, with this very strange minimum wage gig for the Seventh-day Adventists at this hospital, go to that group and say, I want to travel around the world. And he goes off on an 18-month tour of India and the Far East, goes through Beirut, which almost no American citizen can get into at that time in the late 70s. It's a war-torn nation, and it's a major center, though, for training of CIA assassins. He goes to Asia, and he's living this kind of life of Riley. I mean, this guy basically takes a year and a half off and goes around the world. But when he comes back, he's depressed. he's so depressed that the only thing that can really make him feel good is the idea of going to New York and shooting John Lennon. Now, Chapman, as somebody who's making minimum wage as a security guard, has incredible artwork collection as well. In fact, he owns Dali painting. So there's something very unusual about this guy, the Seventh-day Adventist group that is sort of managing him over there in Hawaii, which is where he goes after he leaves Georgia. And then he ends up taking off and going to New York. And he has this girlfriend, Gloria, as I've mentioned. And she makes a note, because when they go through his things, they find one of her kind of notebooks at his place. And she makes a note, Mark has finished The Catcher in the Rye. And that's 2 days before he goes to New York. So there's something to him finishing this book. Now, the original story was, oh, he always worshipped this book, Catcher in the Rye, and, you know, he saw Lennon as a villain because of the book and all this other stuff. He only read the book in August, and he commits the assassination in December. So the programming tool is obviously in the Catcher of the Rye book. And the author is quite fascinating. He's shown up in a couple of our episodes, and the character, that's J.D. Salinger, and the character Holden Caulfield is the one who's trying to, you know, prevent this corruption from coming into the world. And how this guy landed on Lennon is very interesting, because he's hanging around there under the guise of being a obsessed fan who wants to get Lennon to sign his autograph, the new album that Lennon has out. And Lennon has been gone off the public stage for 5 years. And it's very interesting because in the traditional history around John Lennon, the whole thing was, oh, he went to become a house husband and all that stuff. But there are stories that, you know, basically his wife, Yoko, had thrown him out and he was traveling around. There was a nanny raising his son and he was traveling to all these countries. And there's a very interesting story that Bowie tells about meeting him in Hong Kong and them going into this club and Lennon, you know, yelling in this kind of strip club that they need to treat him better because he was a Beatle and them throwing him out. So, you know, this idea of Lennon being like, I'm at home now, it's just not true. So, but this is the PR thing that they kind of came out with. It's Lennon is a house husband now and Ono runs the show. So he comes out with this remarkable album after 5 years of laying off. That's not doing anything for 5 years. It's pretty remarkable. But he was very much in the crosshairs of the Nixon and Ford administration efforts to deport him because they saw him as a political liability and somebody who could put together concerts and, you know, freedom rallies and all the political activities that he did being so active there in the 1972 presidential election to no avail because Nixon won handily. But they saw him and, you know, if Lennon snapped his fingers, he could get 20, 30, 40,000 people together to do a protest or something. So I think they saw him rising back on the political level, coming back on the career side. And, you know, it's a classic thing about them trying to get him out of the country and tapping his phone and people following him and the whole kind of Men in Black scenario is thick with Lennon. In 74 and 75, you know, he is somebody who's being led into paranoia because he's being followed so much. Famously has a very interesting UFO sighting in the middle of all that. So Lennon, really, by the time he reemerges here, the Reagan administration is about to take over. My feeling is that there was a contract hanging out back there during the Nixon-Ford era, which was to get rid of Lennon. And when Nixon hit Watergate and all that stuff, they, you know, we know he was on their enemies list and all the rest, and that they just, you know, weren't able to connect. And he won in 1976. His hearing to allow him to stay in the country. They couldn't deport him on some phony drug charge. Not that he didn't take drugs, but that the charge that they had against him wasn't enough to deport him on. So he moves into the Dakota building, and it's very interesting because the Dakota is the site of Rosemary's Baby, and, you know, there's all kinds of unusual things about the Dakota building. But one of the oddest things about the Dakota is that the person who is the doorman, Jose Perdomo, is somebody who was very involved in the Bay of Pigs action. And he was one of these anti-Castro people who were trained by the CIA, who were Cuban, to go in there and take over the country. He's the doorman. So you could say, you know, let's say it this way, a retired CIA operative. So that's kind of the claim.
How long was he the doorman?
He had been there since 1970, and Lenin had moved in 75. So let's take a look at this picture here. You've got Chapman traveling the world on, he shouldn't have any money, but he can go anywhere he wants. He's got an art collection, girlfriend. He's living the life of Riley on $3.25 an hour. Lenin, this worldwide peace symbol activist who had gone really underground and really been, probably been freaked out by the campaign against him. That's why he disappeared for 5 years. And Perdomo on the end there in his Cuban getup, fighting for the Americans to get Cuba back, who becomes the doorman. Now, the scene of the assassination is a very strange scene because it's told a number of different ways over time. But one of the things I want to point out is that even the trip that Chapman makes when he goes to New York, and this is after his world tour, it's after the Depression, after being in the hospital, after them giving him a job, and the Seventh-day Adventists kind of taking care of his needs. And there is an important point there that the Seventh-day Adventists is probably good people involved in groups like that. Don't get me wrong. But there is a, just like with the Mormons, there's such a deep CIA connection that the CIA targeted the Mormons and wanted to control, you know, their output and all the rest of it. Well, on the same level, the Seventh-day Adventists have a kind of a unique relationship with the DOD. So keep that in mind as we go along here. Now, what happens is, he's hanging around a lot, as I mentioned, and he's outside of the Dakota. At one point, he's seen climbing up the building, that is, maybe to try to get in the window or something. And even though there are famous people in there, and you know, people know Lenin lives in there, you don't see that too much. You don't see groupies trying to climb the building. So there are very telltale signs that something unusual, very, very strange is going on here. So what happens is that just previous to his assassination of Lenin, or his participation in that action and then taking the fall, there's another star who lives close by to John Lennon, and that is James Taylor. And James Taylor, you know, the folk singer, he was actually discovered by the Beatles, and he was one of their first artists who they put out his first album because they were looking, they created Apple, the label, and they were looking for acts to sign so that they could stop being the focus of everything and be like, you know, let's promote some other people. And James Taylor is one of their early guys. So James Taylor happens to live close by to Lennon there over in New York, in the Upper East Side. And, he's walking down the street and he encounters Chapman coming out of the subway, and Chapman sees him and he starts having something like an epileptic fit and talking a mile a minute. But I'm going to give you Taylor's description of this frenzied meeting with this MK Ultra victim, Chapman. And what I want you to really pay attention to is the fact that the mechanism is being triggered a little bit early here. James Taylor contacted Tom Brook, the first British journalist to report live from outside the Dakota on that fateful winter day, about his experience with Mark David Chapman. The Fire and Rain singer revealed to Brooke that Lennon's killer had confronted Taylor at the entrance of the 72nd Street subway stop one day earlier, December 7th. The guy, this is Taylor now, the guy had sort of pinned me to the wall and was glistening with maniacal sweat and talking some freak speak about what he was going to do and his stuff and with how and how John Lennon was interested and he was going to get in touch with John Lennon. Taylor told Brooke it was surreal to actually have contact with the guy. He was very weird, and this was 24 hours before he shot John. As Taylor would later tell the Telegraph, Chapman followed him toward his apartment half a block north 73rd Street. He finally left after Taylor nervously told his building's doorman that the crazed man was following him and was not a guest. He was glistening with sweat with a crazy look in his eye, Taylor later recalled. His eyes were darting all over the place and dilated like crazy. Let me say that again. His eyes were darting all over the place and dilated like crazy. To me, the guy seemed either drugged or in a manic break of some sort. I thought, man, there are some freaky people in New York, and that's about as much as I thought of it at the time. I think it's pretty clear that the fact that he's sent to assassinate a famous person and then he sees one, but it's not the right target, has him go into this very strange frenzy. The night before he assassinates Lennon, he also is staying in one of the most expensive hotels in New York, and he orders up a very expensive escort service to send him an escort for the evening. So somebody, you know, is laying out quite a feast of expense on behalf of Mr. Chapman. This also goes to the Lee Harvey Oswald story, because again, when you look at Oswald and you see the nature of his life, it doesn't add up with what they talk about with him, you know, working for minimum wage at the Texas School Book Depository. He, yes, he had been part of the military, but he had been all over the world and traveling the world as well. He'd been to Finland, lived in Russia. When he was in Minsk, they gave him 3,000 rubles a month, which is incredible. In his own apartment, he lived like a king. So, you know, these are people who, once they tap into the network, nothing makes sense about the regular story of their lives versus what actually they can do. So just to summarize it with Chapman: art collection, world travel for years, expensive hotels, expensive call girls. You know, somebody is massaging him into place. The evidence is clear, because nobody can explain where all that money comes from. Very clear around a number of these people in terms of how they get put into a particular position as well. And I want to point that out in relation, if we go to the Thomas Crook situation, when he's flying that drone over Butler, PA, just before the president gets there, he's under protection. So the intelligence agency that set up that situation is giving him the protection to do it. And later they might want the story that he ran the drone, because then they'll be like, aha, you know, this proves what he had the intention to do this right away. That has to be, whenever somebody is moved into position that easily, you know, he was so close to the president and all the rest of it, that shows the pre-design by a larger agency involved. Keep that in mind as we go here. The morbid irony of the situation was not lost on James Taylor. Less than one day after Mark David Chapman chased him to his front doorstep, the disgruntled fan would do the same thing to the former Beatle, except this time with far more tragic consequences. For all intents and purposes, Taylor was lucky. Chapman wasn't just after any star. He'd become disillusioned with Lennon, specifically after reading J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye. Now, when the attempt on President Reagan happened, and that was only 2 months after Lennon was assassinated, Bush was the VP, and he was basically, they were meant to remove Reagan and put Bush in. Bush had run for president, but couldn't get any votes. And he was running against Reagan, and Reagan was beating him like 50-7% or something. So, you know, Reagan had a wide, wide lead over this guy. And I think what they decided to do was to say, we'll use Reagan to get into office with all this rah-rah American patriotism stuff. Reagan will think he's on a roll, and then we'll just bump him off and install Bush. Now, they would install Bush later under normal election circumstances in 1988, but here they have a mechanism for rolling him out. So this period is also another season of assassination that happens. And you have the assassination attempt of the Pope in 1981, which is extraordinary. It never happened before except for poisoning. And that wasn't admitted. You have the assassination of Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt. You have the attempted assassination of Reagan. You have the assassination of Lenin. All of that takes place from December to April of 1981. That is what you call a season of assassination. And as I mentioned in the Kennedy case, you had Kennedy, De Gaulle, the attempt on De Gaulle, the Diem brothers, the UN secretary, you know, the displacement of the entire government of the UK, the government of Laos, you know, all of these different governments falling in succession, the leaders being taken out or the attempt to take the leaders out. Those are forces moving that need to do something in a particular time frame. So you can see that pattern and how it operates. So we need to keep that in mind as we go forward, looking at these MKUltra cases. And of course, we'll do more beyond the special report around MKUltra with these things coming up. Now, everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. This is Deep State Assassinations Revealed, MKUltra, the program, the social engineering, the timeline that we're in, and how this all plays out. Of course, we're going to be taking your questions here in just a couple minutes. And before I go any further, what do you got?
Debbie McAdoo says, this may be a dumb question, but what was the incentive behind assassinating Lenin? Katie Cat says, May Pang talked about how he was trying to break free from Yoko Ono, who controlled him. Maybe that was it. She controlled him for the deep state. He was coming back into public life, and that could be a threat.
Yeah, I think that, you know, even without Yoko, they had a big, big problem with John Lennon, because Reagan was going to be, you know, the CIA through Reagan was going to be initiating an entire war with the Contras. They were going to do the whole crack epidemic thing. And the CIA was getting back to what they were doing really in the 1960s. They had just been offshored a little bit during the 1970s. When it became obvious they were involved in the Kennedy assassinations, they were overthrowing governments, you know, so they got a little slap on the wrist there, but they didn't really go away at all. So the whole drug piece and everything that they needed to do, and then the buildup of the nuclear thing against the Russians at the time, I don't think they could tolerate the reemergence of Lenin, who they, after all, wanted to deport, you know, 10 years earlier. And didn't get the chance to. The only reason I think that they didn't finish the job on Lenin, or at least get rid of him to back to the UK, was because the Nixon government fell, and when Ford took over, he didn't really have the power. And so I think they lost the target, but I think the contract lingered on, unfortunately. I'm going to stick with this Lenin thing for a moment, because I think some important things are coming through. The Hawaii thing is interesting too, because we have a deep black program, black projects piece in Hawaii, training agents, and it shows up over and over again. But it's particularly spotlighted in the Chapman case. A reporter from Hawaii, and this is from the Mind Games Assassination of John Lennon book, which is fairly new. I think it came out in the last 2 years. There's a lot of very interesting things in here. A reporter from Hawaii found out that Mark Chapman was John Lennon's alleged assassin, and that he had a wife in Hawaii way ahead of the Bang Pack outside of the 20th Precinct. Really? How did that happen? Gloria does not say how the alleged reporter knew in which police station Mark Chapman was being held and to what contact details and call protocols were. When Gloria made the phone call, the NYPD had only been able to verify Mark Chapman's name under 3 hours, and it had not been made officially public. This is important because this Gloria woman has incredible access in calling the NYPD to get details and other things. And somehow there's a Hawaiian reporter who's getting advanced material that even the police haven't released. So there's something very strange about the Hawaii-New York nexus on this case. Now, when John was confirmed dead, it was Barbara and Dea's job to wash John's body. These are the two nurses that attended the surgery. By the way, another strange thing I want to point out is that the person who came forward on the night of the assassination and said, "I did the surgery on John Lennon," didn't. And this guy maintained for 30 years that he was the one who did the surgery. 30 years later, it was exposed that it was a different surgeon who worked on Lennon, and this guy had been lying for 30 years. Now, that's a fact in the public. But why did this guy come forward and say that he had done it? How was he not taken down by other people in the hospital who knew that he didn't do it? And why was it so important for him to do the surgery and all the rest? Well, he was somebody who came out and said, Lennon, you know, had these bullet wounds that were consistent with Chapman shooting him. The nurses involved both confirmed to me unequivocally and in full agreement with Dr. Halloran, who was the actual doctor who did the surgery. And what he said was, all of the wounds that killed John Lennon all came from a gun that was firing at him from the front. 5 shots were fired at him, 4 shots hit him, all from the front. And the traditional story, of course, has Chapman in the background there. Now, we're used to it in the Kennedy assassination with all the rigmarole that they did there, in the RFK assassination, in others. They're able to manipulate that level of information. However, when you get the surgeon who worked on the wounds with the nurses and they say it, well, that's a different thing, no, isn't it? This case, I think, is going to open up dramatically based on this, the more it gets out. Dr. Halloran and the nurses said that John had 4 entrance wounds in his upper left chest, just above his heart. 3 bullets exited in direct line of fire out of John's back. They both assumed that one of the bullets stayed in John, and this was the one nearest to his shoulder. They were convinced that the bullets did not move around and went straight through John. Barbara Kammerer also told me that the anesthetist, Ellis Egan, agreed with them and that there were 4 wounds in Lennon's upper left chest, something Egan could clearly see when she was working on his body. In case you have lost count, that is 4 people who verified that Lennon was shot 4 times in his chest. The doctor, 2 nurses, and the anesthetist. So, did they all get it wrong in exactly the same way? The nurses were aware over the years that Chapman had consistently claimed he shot Lennon 4 times in the back from 20 feet away. The nurses both agreed that this would be impossible considering the tight professional grouping of the wounds in John's chest. They both assumed that Lennon must have turned somehow and that the shooter must have been just 5 feet away from him. Both women, and remember, they were nursing professionals, described how the dramatic movie, The Lennon Report, a film made with the specific intention of clearing up the medical inconsistencies in Lennon's murder, had to be altered and adjudicated several times as it was being shot, when the filmmakers kept insisting that John was shot back to front. The nurses were adamant that Lennon was, in actual fact, shot in the left interior chest area. Depressingly, a crew member stated that they were only following what Wikipedia said. Oh, Barbara told them that no one called Wikipedia was in the emergency room when John Lennon was being treated. And the nurses are very adamant now coming out and saying it. And they had an interview with the actual surgeon who worked on Lennon. And he said, they say, look, in your report, you said he was shot in the front. All the wounds came from the front. And he said, yeah, that's, you know, basically based on my medical knowledge, that's what it was. And they said, what do you think of the fact that, you know, this other guy took credit for doing the surgery and that he gave the wrong information? And he, you know, that doctor is very like low profile guy. He doesn't want to get involved in controversy. He's like, I don't know why they did that. You know, he just came out and spoke within the last year. So that case, the way that we understand it and the whole thing about the, you know, loser Chapman who was unhappy and wanted to take it out on John Lennon, just like Oswald wanted to take it out on JFK and all the rest. These are programs. And you're going to hear this program when we come up with these different things. Crooks, they have this same program going on. And, you know, there's no question that there are people like that out there, but their ability to access these high security situations barely exists. And so it's highly suspect when we get the patsy and then the same wraparound, the patsy, over and over again. Everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show, deep, deep tonight on the programming of these deep state assassination patsies revealed and the MKUltra that's involved there. I'm going to turn now to your questions with Miss Olivia, since we're going to wrap up tonight, say within the next half hour or so, and I want to make sure we get your questions in. So I turn it over to you, Miss Olivia.
Sun Hero says, DJ, do you believe they use the same techniques as the ones used in the movie The Manchurian Candidate? And Zero Infinity Live says, what is the significance of using the three-name format for assassins?
Well, I've heard a lot of interesting explanations for that. One of them is that they don't want people who have that actual name. They use the middle name to really differentiate them. So that if somebody is named Mark Chapman, they don't want to stigmatize them forever, so they use the middle name. Although I will tell you that in the case of Lee Oswald and others, the three-name thing, I mean, it is pretty obvious that they use this. John Wilkes Booth and all the rest. One of the things that I can point to, what was the other part of that question?
The different techniques.
Yes, Manchurian Candidate.
My volume's too low, by the way.
Oh, is it? Is it? Should be good now.
Okay.
Usually it's more conservative to play it with you since you're such a big projector. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. The techniques have improved so drastically since that era. But think about it. The information that we got, you know, and that other nations got as well during the end of World War II, the Nazis had perfected a kind of mind control program. And earlier, if you go back into other, there were assassination guilds going back into the 18th, 19th century, further back than that, and they use all kinds of mind control techniques in those secret societies, and which is going to remind me to read that Gurdjieff quote, because remember, we have that mystery school thing balancing out some of the worse impulses around this. But I think what they... the techniques that they have now, you know, their drug delivery techniques, their electronic manipulation, their virtual reality command, you know, that is an ever-growing piece. Part of the problem with the society, I think, the way that it is the disconnect between the techniques and the science and the medicine and other things that these people have. You know, some of those, you know, World Economic Forum types are coming out openly and talking about what happens. You know, they expect to have people living to 140 and 150 years old. You know, but they're on a depopulation track with everything that they're doing. So what are they going to do with us? you know, that becomes kind of a major problem in society they've got the longevity thing. They already think there's too many people on the planet. They already can't keep up, you know, with the resources and hold their incredible, mighty position. So what do you do with everyone else as the population grows? You can't, you know, how are you going to hide people living to 150 years old? Well, you're going to stage their deaths maybe when they turn 100, like Kissinger. But, you know, it's an interesting point, which is we're moving into a different field. The problem is the information that should be publicly available and integrated into society, not to be overly idealistic about this, except that I think we should be idealistic, is that the entire society should be benefiting from all of the things that we know around advanced energy, the breakthrough technologies, the exotic technologies, the UFO file.
They're not into sharing.
No, no, but this is the problem. So if you track this historically, and it's very funny because this, you know, this goes back literally to the Revolutionary War. It's certainly present in the Civil War with Lincoln. But by the time you get to Kennedy, as I said, there's a kind of genesis for what we're in now. And Kennedy, he is on that elite level. His father is one of the richest men in the world at that point. And he has grown up in a life of privilege. His father was ambassador to the UK and the head of the SEC and this incredible businessman. And he's connected with all these different things. But what does he want to do? He wants to level that field. And he doesn't want it to be one little group up here controlling everything. He wants the space program to bring everyone together. He wants peace, you know, where we must reexamine our attitudes towards the Russians. You know, in the final analysis, he says at the American University speech, we all inhabit the small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future, and we are all mortal. Well, that's John Kennedy. You know, he got that speech around the State Department and the CIA. He snuck that speech in June of 1963. And that is kind of the final straw in many ways for those groups, because they're like, he's humanizing the Russians. The whole point is, you know, if we need to go to war with these people, they have to be dehumanized. And he's saying they're just like us. You know, this is a major, you know, revision of history, because we have a kind of lot of false history going on about how these things have gone. In fact, what took place in the 1960s was a civil war, and the good side lost. This other thing took over, and they've been in some level of power ever since. Now, that whole thing never got exposed, so we have the leftovers of it. And as I said, when those groups operate, if they cannot take things directly at the ballot box, they resort to other means. And I think that's what gets us into these situations or these seasons of assassination. And, you know, we'll wait to see what has taken place with the Kirk situation. The tragedy of it is with everybody. And, you know, this is somebody who was out there publicly working from a traditional religious place, influencing the social fabric, but he was, and he was doing it on the college campuses. You know, I mean, I think it's very obvious that this is exactly the kind of thing that those groups don't want. So you're looking at a tremendous clash there. And if anything, I think we can take from all of these different leaders and situations and the clashes that they've had, and even from people like Lennon, who is not a perfect person, but is an incredible musician, right? Incredible entertainer, and had an incredible sense of political identity. Well, somebody like that, you know, their need to remove those people. And you can see that throughout. You know, there's a statement by Joe Rogan recently when he said all of these people came forward and thanked him for having President Trump on his show before the election hit. And he said they all wanted to say something, or, you know, all the people who were talking to him, who were pretty big people in the entertainment industry, wanted to say something in favor of Trump over the Biden disaster and the, you know, Kamala Waltz freak show thing they were trying to launch on us, but they weren't allowed to. So that type of control can't be tolerated in what is a free, open society. So, you know, getting this exposed and getting it out is a very, you know, difficult process, just like taking control of the border and trying to deport all the people that the Biden administration brought in order to tilt the democracy and create in their direction and create chaos and to destroy the budget and everything else. You know, changing that and reversing that, it's a clash. It's a tremendous movement. It's like turning an entire aircraft carrier around. And, you know, it is fraught with all kinds of frailties of the human variety and all kinds of questions. And so, you know, this is the era, the piece that we're in. I think if we can keep in mind that we've been through this and we've watched their techniques, and if we can say that something in the case of, like, you know, I've been using the Lenin case a lot tonight because I think it's important with the information that's coming out. If we can say how these things are manipulated in the culture, if we have that knowledge, so it took 40 years for that information to come out, right? We can't wait 40 years, you know, in this stage of the game, we can't wait five. We need that information right away. So, you know, the type of thing of the government cover-up level, the things that I've seen in Congress around transparency, you know, we talked about the Luna Task Force and all that, you know, terrible. I mean, they don't know what they're doing. So they don't know how to approach these issues. You know, I don't know what kind of intentions that they had going into it, but my feeling is on the UFO side, they're being manipulated, and it's the worst type of military setups that they're doing. They're trying to create a threat again so that they can have a sky event threat and consolidate emergency powers. It's very obvious. And I want more people and podcasters and everything else to catch up on that, because it is happening. I mean, this is what they're trying to do. And when it hits this kind of level of exposure, then they do have to back off, you know, and because if the plan is out there, then they look stupid because the public knows what they're up to. And that's the nature of what we're talking about. Yes.
Kitty Cat, the whole narrative around Charlie and his killer is so staged, and they are trying to rush the process and then bury it. We will not find the truth in the media or the Trump FBI. It's such a blunder. Larry Hillman says, very suspicious of the official story. I'm wondering if there's an attempt to start a civil war. Robinson may be a patsy. And Kate says, and they said he used a Mauser. That was the rifle they initially identified in the JFK assassination.
Exactly, exactly. This is such a weird thing. This is the Mauser. This is weird, too, because they were saying, you know, there are some experts who were like, it's very hard to disassemble this gun. But the idea was, supposedly he disassembled it, but then when they found it, and then, you know, they just happened to have this box ready for it, it's all assembled again. So you're going to disassemble it, jump off the roof, run over there into the woods, and then reassemble it while people might be chasing you? You know, does not ring right. Some of the things that they say were on the cartridges also, I think are worth looking at. Hey, fascist, catch. Oh, Bella Ciao, that whole thing, which is, you know, the Italians fighting the fascists, supposedly. And notices bulges, O-W-O. What's this? Right. You know,
furry language.
Yeah. So, you know, It's a little bit quaint, I have to say. A few things that came right out of that case felt a little bit strange to me. And it's a difficult situation, so you don't know. But I don't think that the tone of the FBI press conference was in any way informative. It was all strangely self-congratulatory and stuff. It's a very difficult situation because of the tragedy involved, but you have to get past some of the things that we're hearing on the surface about this. And of course, we have to wait to hear more because we don't have all the facts in yet. For example, if he's on Discord with all these people, where are the people he's on Discord with? And does that constitute then conspiratorial activity? Are they sure that he's the guy on the roof? And the Mauser, of course, is the original rifle that was discovered in the affidavits in the Kennedy case. Three of those affidavits of the first policeman on the scene, Roger Craig, Eugene Boone, and Seymour Weitzman, all said that it was a Mauser. And Weitzman owned a gun shop. You think he's not going to know the difference between a Carcano rifle and a Mauser? He'll know. What's interesting is in the Kennedy case, just to flash there for a second, Craig says that they pointed and they said, look, it's a 7.65 Mauser stamp on the barrel. I mean, you can't, you know, if you think about that as memory, that's, I mean, how much more evidence can you get? If they look at it and they see the stamp, it's not like, oh, he looked at it and he didn't, you know, he misidentified it, even though he was a gun expert. Well, if you see the stamp, then you're doing more than misidentifying it, right? You're hallucinating. So, obviously, the Mauser is strange here symbolically. You know, I will say that right off the bat. A Mauser isn't even really, you know, I mean, you would picture somebody using something else for something like this. Yes, Miss Olivia.
The Buddhist of Boston Sports. The FBI caught the Kirk shooter after 33 hours of searching and 33 days before Charlie's birthday. Who is behind it? Jen Passavant says, interestingly, the IDF is known for their next shot assassinations. And CR user says the reason Charlie Kirk was, quote, hit in the throat was, in his opinion, to silence him.
Oh.
You know, throat chakra. There you got it.
It's terrible. I've seen different analysis. We'll wait for more analysis, but I'll tell you, it does not seem to me, unless we find out that this kid was some kind of gun expert, you know, there's a gun culture maybe that is around there. I don't know if that makes any difference to how good of a shot he was. But,
well, his father was a cop. We know that.
Yeah, his father is a policeman, a sheriff, works in the sheriff's office. Yeah, there's more detail needs to come out. But the idea of this guy going up there and taking the shot doesn't wash because of the nature of that. You know
what it is? It's that it feels incomplete. We know something's missing. I don't know what his part is in all of this yet.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us do about him being a patsy or someone,
yeah.
But he's not the only one, and we can just feel it intuitively. It's
yeah,
this is a totally
absolutely
incomplete story right now.
I think a lot more needs to come out. The strange thing is the people who were very close where the questions were being asked said as soon as it happened, the guy behind him starts confessing to it, doesn't have a weapon, doesn't have anything. Then an old man starts yelling out, shoot me, and running around. And we know the police grab him, and he's the one that gets flashed on all the cameras everywhere. That's a pretty good distraction. You know, it reminds me of the epileptic, the mm-hmm. Kennedy case. And the epileptic gets the police all looking in the wrong way, so, you know, they can't see the setup. And then they put the epileptic in the ambulance. And when the ambulance gets to the hospital, they open the door of the back thing and the epileptic is gone. So he never checked in. So that was all just a staged thing. So you have to watch for that when you are looking at these events. There are things that happen that are just random that look worse than they are and all the rest of it. The number of hand signals that were going on behind him as he was speaking seemed unusual to me that much activity is going on just before somebody is shot. But, you know, we'll look and we'll wait for more explanations around this. But, you know, certainly it's an unusual scenario, and we'll just have to wait to see exactly how unusual it gets. What else you got?
Okay, this is really important. I really want to get to this. So So I'm going to loop these together. George Jetson says, mind control is easier when you're traumatized. DA says, DJ, do you think they're trying to pull a mass MK Ultra on the population to cause a civil war? Karen Carpenter says, how might this assassination be used for social engineering and manipulation, even if not a deep state planned event? So never let a good crisis go to waste. And also Karen Carpenter, can you give us an update or refresher on Ahriman and the eighth sphere as it ties into this week's events or current trends? And this was my question this week.
Oh, wow. Absolutely. Well, look, you know, you can for sure look forward to us doing a show about the environment, you know, and the amount of unusual things going on with the social engineering and how it correlates very much with things that people like Rudolf Steiner and others were saying about the period we were moving into in the 21st century and the kind of battle that's going on that isn't always so clear on the surface. You know, I have this thing about hypnotism here I was going to read, but I'm going to read a real quick quote from, since you mentioned this mystery school part, and that's Steiner's Ahriman and Eighth Sphere concept, which is important to consider. Here's something. This comes from the Gurdjieff-Ouspensky work, and it's Gurdjieff talking about identification. And the way that he speaks about identification, I think, is particularly important for the period that we're in, because what they're using for this mind control is to get someone so dedicated that they believe that they're right and doing the right thing, that they'll commit the most monstrous acts. That's the key behind MKUltra as well. But listen to this, and also remember, they're in the Russian Revolution, Gurdjieff period, and they're studying it from the point of view of the intense hypnosis and brainwashing that's going on around these movements in that period where they're overthrowing the Tsar and the Bolsheviks and all the rest. Okay. Quote, this is Gurdjieff now. Identification is so common a quality that for purposes of observation, it's difficult to separate it from everything else. Man is always in a state of identification. Only the object of identification changes. A man identifies with a small problem which confronts him, and he completely forgets the great aims with which he began his work. He identifies with one thought and forgets other thoughts. He is identified with one feeling, with one mood, and forgets his own wider thoughts, emotions, and moods. In work on themselves, people are so much identified with separate aims that they fail to see the see the wood from the trees. Two or three trees nearest to them represent for them the whole woods. Identifying is one of the most terrible foes because it penetrates everywhere and deceives a man at the moment when it seems to him that he is struggling with it. It is especially difficult to free oneself from identifying because a man naturally becomes more easily identified with the things that interest him the most. To which he gives his time, his work, his attention. In order to free himself from identifying, a man must be constantly on guard and be merciless with himself. That is, he must not be afraid of seeing all the subtle and hidden forms that identifying takes. It is necessary to see and to study identifying to be the very roots in oneself. The difficulty of struggling with identifying is still further increased by the fact that when people observe it in themselves, they consider it a very good trait and call it enthusiasm, zeal, passion, spontaneity, inspiration, and names of that kind. They consider that only in a state of identifying can a man really produce good work, no matter in what sphere. The reality, of course, is that this is illusion. Man cannot do anything sensible when he is in a state of identifying. That takes us to a really deep track, because what's happening, what they're able to do really with social media and, you know, the general kind of blaring out of ideas constantly is they get you to identify with a particular thing, whether it's I'm a superior liberal, or, you know, I'm a biblical conservative and I'm the right one, you know. And it goes to a point where you identify so much, and this is particularly happening on the left now, that you identify with it to such a point that you can no longer tolerate that there's another side. So this is the roots of that war of all against all, which Steiner talked about, the ultimate result being your right side of the body fights with the left side of the body. That's where this thing is being manipulated into. And it takes that mystery school understanding of breaking through that so we can see, oh, they're making these people over-identify with being, you know, they're defenders of this particular human right or that particular human right without seeing the picture of what they're doing or taking the rights away from others or downplaying others or making others into the deplorables, right?
Yeah. Also, I've been watching for the past 2 days a lot of Charlie Kirk's debates with young people who use talking points, but then they can't follow it up with any actual data. So, you know, yes. This is very thin understanding.
Right. They understand at surface level.
Yeah. And then they panic when they're questioned about it because understand. So it's not their opinion. It's something they read. It's something they heard. It's the approved viewpoint. And, you know, they're young people. And what I find more than anything is that the problem really, when we get beyond that, is that these people have no relationship to the earth, to soil.
Interesting. Yeah.
Farming,
yeah.
Or to, and you, everyone knows I'm a massage therapist, to the human body, you know, and we, this is the stuff that gets you past the words, the symbols, the archetype, you know.
Just they're ungrounded.
Flesh and blood.
Yes.
But dealing with reality.
Excellent point. You know, it's interesting because the one of the things about the Gurdjieff work, there are these fantastic stories that when Gurdjieff first hit the New York circuit coming over from Russia, all these intellectuals sought him out. And so they showed up at this place and like this farm in New York. And they were like, you know, we can't wait to get this treatise on the universe from Gurdjieff and all these special techniques from the East and all this stuff. And he would put aprons on them and say, into my kitchen, you know, and he'd have them washing dishes and stuff like that. And a lot of them were like, what? You know, the guy, Christopher Isherwood, who wrote Cabaret, he tells something very interesting about this. Like, he loved watching all these intellectuals completely melt down with this idea that we have to go in there and like wash dishes. Like, and Gurdjieff is trying to deliver that message that you have to be grounded. You know, this isn't going to be a theosophical walk in the cosmic park with the ascended masters. You're going to have to be grounded to get all this. Now, by the way, I think that the theosophical walk with the cosmic masters is a good thing to aim for. But there is something, I think, to Gurdjieff in the grounding thing that reminds me of what you were just saying. I'm going to read, while we still have time here, this May Brussel thing about the Lenin assassinations. I've been in that wave and thinking about this. And then we'll take a couple more questions. We'll be done. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. This is Deep State Assassinations Revealed. We've been working with that deep state for a long time. It's been here. It's been in control. And it has, you know, created a revolt against our entire system. And its exposure and, you know, being able to cope with the deep events that force, that system is able to bring to bear, require a kind of awareness that comes only in particular areas, you know. And one of the things about identification, I want to say this, you know, over and over again, you have, just like with the the liberal Trump-hating thing. They're willing to abandon all the rules in order just to make sure Trump doesn't succeed, right? And however you think about Trump, it's an kind of absurdist level of obsession that they have with this. I have a theory about why that's true with Trump. It's because through Roy Cohn, he knows where all those deep state bodies are buried. And through his uncle and Vannevar Bush, he knows enough about the UFO file, maybe with Nixon's involvement as well, to be kind of a player on the same level with, you know, and they're used to presidents being, you know, we'll be able to blackmail you or we'll be able to push you into our position because you're not on the same level with us. So I think a lot of the peeling people off the ceiling about Trump in the structure is about that. But what they do is they funnel it down and they say, you know, here's your script for the day. Trump's bad because of this and this and this and this. And then they tie in the entire movement of, you know, anything on the Republican side or anything conservative. And by the way, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green Party, it doesn't matter. As long as you are working with the Constitution, none of those party labels are going to make a difference. But what I will say, it's important, I think, for us to get this point. They have identified themselves so strongly with this that their entire identity is wrapped up in it. You know, I have people that I know who have moved to other countries to avoid the Trump dictatorship, you know. This is how they've been programmed. So one of the things I think the events from this week show us is that what they can't get at the ballot box, they're trying to get through chaos. So it needs to be something, you know, it is a moment, I think, where we can really look at these things. And for me, it seems like their prescription is chaos. So, you know, we need to have our awareness around this because that game of manipulation, they can come over and manipulate the other side, you know, in order to create this clash. And so then you have all sides working against the future of the country. You have to be very careful, I guess is the point. But I'm going to read this Brussels quote and then we'll take your last questions. How's that? All right. Here's what she had to say. So she gets this question. This is Mae Brussels talking about the Lenin assassination. The common assumption is that Mark David Chapman was arrested the moment he killed John Lennon, was acting on his personal love-hate relationship with Lennon. Why do you look for a larger conspiracy than the conflict in Chapman's own head? And this is Mae now. She says, single crimes of passion are easy to explain and solve. When someone is gunned down who's controversial, has political enemies, is hated by the wealthy and well-organized religious movements, and is an open opponent of government policies at home and abroad, that kind of murder requires much more inquiry into the background of the assassin. The conclusions about the murder motive may turn out to be simple, yet in every political assassination since 1963, there were always more unanswered questions that led to a broader supposition of intention to kill by a group of people rather than a single individual. Now, she's writing here in the 1980s. If you fast forward that 20 years, again, that pattern of assassination reflects that it's a group of people more than a lone nut patsy guy, a little more. Who was Mark David Chapman? What was there in his background that made you suspicious that he had been selected as a decoy or a patsy by other persons who wanted Lennon dead? Chapman came from a conservative military family who had moved to Fort Worth, Texas, to Florida from Fort Worth. He became a Jesus freak at the time that Lennon and the Beatles were receiving death threats during the anti-war period, joining the religious movement, which supposedly loving and admiring Lennon was a gross contradiction. The fundamentalists were furious that Lenin considers himself better known and loved than Jesus. That's also a misquote that they put around there, that Lenin said this thing, well, the Beatles were bigger than Jesus, and they ran that around and made him, you know, the KKK showed up and threatened the Beatles and all that. DeKalb County, Georgia, just to the east of Atlantis, figures prominently in Chapman's life, as it had some years earlier, and that of Martin Luther King. In a 1977 court affidavit, Robert Watson, a former employee of Magellan's Art Gallery in Atlanta, named several citizens who planned and boasted of the pending murder of Reverend Martin Luther King. King's death came just a week after the plans were discussed. These are the same people who also talked about murdering Senator Robert Kennedy. Chapman attended DeKalb Junior College. Chapman was sent to Beirut, Lebanon, as I mentioned. He was handed the funds both ways. Beirut was the center of George Habash and CIA assassination teams, also identified in Watson testimony before the House Select Committee in 77 to 78. Now, we've lost our connection with this information that came out at a certain point through Congress about the Central Intelligence Agency, about these intelligence agencies. That's why you have the dum-dum meetings in Congress around the UFO file. And you have people sitting there saying, look, I found this videotape magically, but it's from a whistleblower. So, you know, we need to make sure we watch out for that threat. This whole thing is that we've lost the ability to see, oh, you know, these things have already come out. They've been investigated. The intelligence agencies have manipulated the public over and over again. It's come out. And it's interesting. She mentions that there about this group that was planning the MLK assassination. In 1997, a jury awarded the King family a judgment of murder by those people, Lloyd Jowers and all those people. So, you know, she's ahead of her time there, some 15 years. You have to get to this, which is what she was getting at when she was looking at the Chapman situation, is what we need to kind of remind ourselves. We've been through this movie before on a number of different occasions. And so when this type of situation comes up, like we saw with the assassination this week, we need to be very leery about simple explanations. We need to take all the evidence into account. And going forward, you know, just like in the Crooks situation, you don't have any information about Crooks. They cremated the body before anybody even knew what was going on there. We have strange things about Crooks and his house and how nobody seemed to live in that house. None of the neighbors recall seeing people coming and going out of that house. It was like a yard guy that would show up every couple of weeks and do the yard, and that's about it. And then the police went into the house. The place was immaculate, you know. That's kind of interesting. It didn't look lived in. So we don't even know about Crooks and the plot to kill President Trump last summer. And, you know, so we're in a kind of a weird phase here where not a lot is being put out. And in my opinion, on the FBI side, when they were coming out and saying, yeah, you know, we don't have anything about Crooks and there's no Epstein thing and all this other stuff, something strange going on there where you have these kind of like truth titans going in. And when they get into the position, they become kind of like church mouse, you know, a little bit quiet there on some of the bigger things. So certainly I would say this, let's look at these situations and get to the bottom of it, but let's go in clear-headed that intelligence agencies and the deep state have created an entire system of control based on assassination. And, you know, before they ramp into another season of assassination, maybe this is the stuff we need to be talking about, which is their MK Ultra control of these, you know, mind controlled assassins who they can just do the real assassination and then pop the patsy in. It's a formula we've seen used over and over again. And, that's where I get on that. Miss Olivia.
I'm going to flip this for a second. I don't know exactly how to ask this, but it seems like on the, okay, we got the MK Ultra assassin thing under control. We kind of get it. What we can't get, there's only so much quote truth that we can get our hands on. And it's because of control files and the people that serve supposedly in elected office or, you know, in positions of power, all have control files. They're all being blackmailed. They're all, you know, being threatened with either exposure or death of their children, their family. We know this is being done, right? So, and I'm just thinking out loud about Charlie Kirk and his faith that, you know, even to unto the death, that this is the thing that they don't want. They don't want us to have faith because that makes us strong, that makes us brave. And where we are willing to challenge even those who say they would kill us and our loved ones to get to restore America.
Well, that's interesting too, because I mean, I think about Bobby Kennedy a lot in this regard and how Bobby Kennedy Jr. took on a lot when he became secretary, and how a lot of even the MAHA people, you know, were turning on him and saying he wasn't doing enough, and he really put himself in the crosshairs. But he, I think, has stood up to that type of scrutiny and in that type of difficulty. And I know that he knows that he's been a pretty big target, especially with his family history, going into a corrupt arena of Fauci and others. So, you know, there are examples that I can point to in this government, and certainly Bobby is one of them. And I want to point this out, which is a lot of the black pill type thing that we see taking over so much of the independent commentary is strange, too, because, you know, they make Bobby Kennedy the enemy. They call him the Judas and all this nonsense. And, you know, show me somebody else who in his position could do more. I mean, he's doing a remarkable job with this. And so I think that this needs to be kind of put front and center as well, which is the people who have been put in there, they represent such a difference from the last administration. And the difference is night and day. Now, you can have some positions in the current government that aren't being, that aren't coming through. But that incredible like cynicism that's supposed to go after certain people, you know, like Kennedy in the administration. I mean, when you said that, when you were talking about, you know, standing up in the face of all that, Bobby Kennedy Jr. definitely came to mind. So that's somebody I would say who's doing a great job. I also think that Gabbard is an asset in this administration. We'll see about the Secretary of State, Rubio, and all that stuff. I've never been a big fan of Rubio. And I think this CIA director, you know, that we have in there is such an outsider, Ratcliffe, that I'm not sure the types of changes that he can get in that agency. And again, through Congress, they haven't done enough to really expose the CIA manipulation. The task force has been incredibly weak when it comes to taking them on. So, you know, there's wins and losses, I think, in the current administration, but certainly there's cause for optimism in all of this. So considering where we were last year with them taking pot shots at Trump and Stepford Biden at the helm, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I would say things are in a better place. Everyone, you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. This is Deep State Assassinations Revealed, MK Ultra. There's more to come on this, but I wanted to make sure that we took it on, and we took it on through the figure of the MK Ultra activities around the assassination of John Lennon, who in his era was one of these incredible celebrated talents, but also was incredibly concerned with politics. And so we can view him through this political lens. I have one last quote to read, and it is about the very strange case of this doctor, Milton Klein.
Oh, wow.
And save the best for last, mm-hmm. right? Milton Klein had talked all about how you could build a Manchurian candidate, and he had done all these things through hypnosis to do it on behalf of the government since the 1950s through something, a behavior modification program named Bluebird. Now, what's very interesting about him is that the lawyer that takes over the Chapman case after he shoots Lennon, the first one who goes out gets all these death threats and he gets off the case. The guy who takes over is actually a CIA lawyer. He's the CIA uses his law firm, Jonathan Sachs, and he hires Dr. Milton Klein to go in and assess Chapman. Chapman, remember, is basically an MKUltra victim, and here's the ultimate architect of one of those. But Klein, maybe as a consultant for the CIA, he has some things to offer here. Okay. Now, this is an article that came out in that period. So this is after the whole thing. It's about 5 years later, after the shooting of Lennon. And what it says is, during the early 1960s, when the CIA was covertly funneling millions of tax dollars into a variety of brainwashing experiments involving LSD and other hallucinogens, an electroshock, Klein provided expertise on hypnosis. He was outspoken in his belief that one of the central goals of these experiments to create a hypnotized remote control assassin was entirely possible, though he denies knowledge of any terminal experiments that could have tested his theories. The fictional Manchurian candidate presented in Richard Condon's Thriller and later in a movie starring Frank Sinatra is, in Klein's mind, still a frighteningly real specter. Quote, it cannot be done by everyone, he argues. It cannot be done consistently, but can be done. Now, interestingly, he goes in and examines Chapman, and Chapman was going to do an insanity defense. And without any supervision, this doctor's in there treating Chapman, very much like how Jack Ruby will get treated by Jolly West and then come out and act like a crazy person. But what happens is Chapman says, I'm changing. He calls up the lawyer and says, I'm changing my plea to guilty from insanity. And the lawyer's like, what are you talking about? We set up this whole thing for insanity. And he said, no, I had a visit. I went into this special place and there were all these generals. And they instructed me that I should be, living a more kind of Christ-like life, and I should be more religious, and I need to plead guilty. So in this weird arena of his mind, Chapman, probably under the tutelage of Klein, is being convinced by these higher powers in his unconscious to go ahead and plead guilty, because Chapman is, pleading insane means they're going to investigate and all the rest of it. If he's guilty, there's no trial. So Klein goes in, the same guy who's talking about how you can do this Manchurian candidate gig, he goes in privately with Chapman, who supposedly, remember, just this low-level guy shoots a celebrity. They get the top MKUltra expert in there on hypnosis. He goes in, and as soon as Chapman comes out, he says, I'm guilty. That's pretty interesting, but seeing all the generals and stuff instructing him that he needs to be religious and go ahead and plead guilty is, I think, a particularly interesting insight as to how they manipulated, in this case, Chapman, which makes him, a victim as well. So, but I will say this, that they were working very deeply there on making sure that that came out and that case came out the way that they wanted to. That's why you see someone on the level of Milton Klein involved. And with that, Miss Olivia, your last question of the evening.
Okay. I'm going to give it to David Tormina. DJ, it's interesting that right when Corso published The Day After Roswell, he testified to Congress about US POWs being brainwashed with various Nazi mind control techniques he was aware of. Oh, yeah. It turns out that after World War II, Willoughby set up a secret base for mind control experiments in Atsugi, Japan.
Oh, far out. Well, Willoughby's very interesting. And we'll tackle more on Willoughby in another episode. By the way, in January of 1980, so 11 months before that assassination took place, High Times, which was the big drug magazine of that period, they ran an article, ex-CIA doc leads fight to limit hypnosis. And the CIA doc was Klein. So he was around there. He was around that public specter. And the only thing they say is hypnotherapist Dr. Klein, former consultant to the CIA's super secret behavior modification project, is currently campaigning for the strict legal constraints on hypnosis, limiting its use to trained members of the health professions. During the early 60s, when the CIA was covertly funneling millions of tax dollars into a variety of brainwashing experiments involving LSD, either another hallucinogens, an electroshock, Klein provided expertise on hypnosis. Could have easily gone in there, checked the mechanism of Chapman, and made him see these generals were going to tell him to lead a righteous life, plead guilty. I mean, the Chapman case is so textbook MK Ultra control. It's just, you know, it boggles the mind that the facts are out there. We need to keep those in mind. What else you got?
I want to bundle these together. Roger Z says the first person shooter video games were developed by the Pentagon. Aaron Carpenter says, is the influence of video games and online culture powerful enough to be considered a cause for radicalization, and does it qualify as, quote, mind control, MKUltra, etc.? Nenna says, and that is the saddest thing. Those computer games teach you to kill, but do not give any indication of the damage to your own soul and mind in doing so. And I'm thinking about the decline in our civilization, and it can absolutely be tracked back to when video games came in.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Atari at first, and then they, you know, they were all fun, Super Mario, all that, and Raiders of the Lost Ark, all that kind of stuff, until, and then they got super violent.
Mm.
And we know this from porn, I hate to say it, but, you know, the watching it virtually isn't enough, right? You want to make it real. You develop a taste for something. The thrill is gone. You've played whatever game it is enough.
Well, they also, the other thing that's interesting about that is they have certain times, just like what was Candy Crush that got into trouble with this, where they were building in addictive themes to it. And that's a whole thing about how to brainwash somebody. Look, video games and the whole culture around video games is so highly manipulated. It reminds me very much of the kind of, you know, horror movie thing that crept in and went to these extreme levels, the slasher films and all the rest of it. And then what you're talking about with pornographic addiction is very much like the video game addictions as well. So, yeah.
Right. And then there's, you know, whatever entrainment and,
it is entrainment,
and things that are embedded kind of. What
well, it's electronic hypnosis. It is. Yeah.
But the nude woman in the ice cube, what is that?
Subliminal.
Subliminal. I mean, what kind of, I mean, I guess you don't really need subliminals because it's all right there, but they might, you know, again, like, Parallax View.
Well, look, they've been dealing with that. The first lawsuit about subliminals happened in the 1950s. Okay. So what are we, 70 some odd years later? Unbelievable. And, I think it is very instructive to look at that track in history as well, because I think we lose a lot of we lose a lot of perspective by limiting ourselves to the era that we're in, because it's so boxed in the way that things are reported. When you see how the whole game is manipulated on the media side and how that manipulation worked, say if you look back 40 years, if you go back into the 90s and look at how they were doing it, and you see the accelerated level that they're on now, that's one or two things. Either they're on a program of acceleration, or their technology has allowed them to just, you know, kind of go into this in a fearless fashion of whether the public is going to be able to catch it or not. So these are the stakes. There's no question about it. I hope we've given you some taste of that tonight. And so we're going to wrap up our special report tonight. I'll do a couple of shout outs though before we go. And if you have any last things,
I will say this on tonight. Polly Mathing says, Century of the Self is a good watch. It is a must watch and is free on YouTube. It's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. Everybody should watch it.
Absolutely incredible. Yeah. Well, that level of suggestion from advertising and putting the public to sleep. There's a wonderful piece in it's another Orwell book. I'm trying to think of which book this is. It might be Down and Out in London and Paris. But it's he has this whole thing about how Corner Table and there's a whole marketing campaign about Corner Table loves his hot chocolate with whipped cream. And Corner Table does this and does that. And he's like the ultimate like functionary in society consumer thing that they're building up through advertising. And he, Orwell says about it, you know, the only thing I saw on these big posters of Corner Table, who's the character who's enjoying all these things, he said, I could see the Nazi bombs like dropping on London, you know, like through the eyes of Corner Table. So that's the 1940s where they have this little marketing lair on top. And I guess things don't really change that much. All right. Before we wrap up, your super chats.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just responding to somebody who I think doesn't like the idea that I'm going to take his video games and his porn away from him.
Like, that's all right.
Just, you know, watch.
Hey, look, live like you want
to. Observe yourself. Live like good for you.
Live like you want to live, but, you know, are you going to be an idiot, you know, in the Gurdjieffian sense of, like, not having a sense of what you are? You have to think about it.
Yeah, maybe moderation, you know, but self-awareness is important for self, you know. Do you want to, who's in control? Is the porn and the video games, are they in control? Is the programming in control? Are you in control? Okay, that's all I'm saying. All right, so John Matthews, Norman Lee Smith Music, Tim Houston, Willie Hartman, Mirror 13, Tracy Klotke, Apotheosis X369X, Chris Stanger, Jessica Rodriguez, Sal A, Eurythmia is Fun, Amarillo Gunrunners, Deathcat Brock, Jackson Langley, Sun Hero, Deborah McAdoo, Erica Swenson Elliott, Gaia Genie, Steve Z, Ray Story, Bar J Provolone, Ricky Tiki Tavi Dallum, and Rich Hall. Thank you so much for your generous super chats.
Provolone, as in the cheese? Mm-hmm. That's a real name there. Thank you so much for your support. And to all our subscribers, thank you. We couldn't do what we do without you, and we appreciate all of your support. We will be back next week with an expanded X-Series episode. We have exciting interviews coming up for you. Of course, part two of the Joseph Farrell interview is available right now at darkjournalist.com. And let me do a couple of shout-outs here. Jason Langley. Good to see you out there. Heather Sansone. Thank you, Heather. She says, bravo, Olivia. I love it. Who are you? Yes. Matt Stu. Uh-huh. Good question. Great point, Project Redfoot. Even though I don't know what you're referring to, I'll go along with that. LOL, like Pink Floyd, The Wall. There's a lot of music references rolling around. Maybe that's another problem, which is music is terrible now, and it lowers the consciousness. Okay, the addiction potentiality makes people violent. True, really good one. Luminessa Lux, very true. Cove Channel, music, movies, AI, on and on. I'll never forget, what's the guy named Wayne?
Dyer?
Wayne Dyer. Mm-hmm. Wayne Dyer was talking about how his son was into rap and was getting like a really bad vibe and was becoming hostile. And he was like, look, hold up. And at the time it was like his son had all these CDs. And he was like, hold the rap CD up to your heart. Now hold a banana next to it. He's like, don't you feel a difference here? He was hilarious. But you know, that's a really, that was a good little lesson there in the moment. Yeah. So we have August, Lester Lepore, Pono, Kelzilla, Wizards and Spells Everywhere. Well, it's not true. Jeez. You know what's funny is I try to click on that one to highlight it, Kelzilla, and they wouldn't put it up. So they don't want your wizard spells revealed. Esther Taylor. It's great to see you out there. Who else have we got? So many great faces out there in the ideas room. Fake book. Take care. DA. We lose our connection to each other. Here's a good one. We lose our connection to each other. Kids don't play outside and socialize anymore. Heart. That's really true. Yeah. Yep. You have to be careful not to get sucked into the machine. And Tormina, those headphones pumped right into your brain.
Can I add something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I just want to say the Charlie Kirk thing, that there are two overriding messages.
Yeah.
That are so valuable to hold on to there. One is that you have to have an ideal. For Charlie, it was a Christian ideal, but it doesn't really matter what it is.
Oh, yeah.
But you have to define it for yourself, and mm-hmm. you have to compare your actions to that ideal all the time. Really commit yourself to it, and to be a great human being, right?
Absolutely.
And that is so valuable. And the other thing that I wanted to mention earlier is that he had an incredible commitment to family, and this is why I think he was very threatening. Is that he always talked about fathers in the home. And this is something I had been thinking about a lot in the past few weeks, actually, is that what really makes a difference, I don't care how this sounds, is in a child's life, more than anything else, is having a strong father, a father with wisdom and...
Oh, it's anathema to the New World controllers. Watch out.
And it's not, I mean, in every community.
Yeah.
So... That's they've worked hard to destroy the nuclear family, and we need to be the ones
absolutely
to bring it back together and value it every day.
Oh, I agree. Hey Now says at Dark Journalist, love you guys. Thank you. Terrific. Thank you, DJ and Olivia. I'm backing up to watch again. There's a lot there to take in. So, oh wait, David's got one. This is good. DJ, your friend Jason Giorgiani seems dead set that we're going to have a civil war and have Nazi dictatorship. It's unavoidable, according to his unimpeachable philosophical knowledge. Great guy. Wow. Well, I no comment on that. But no, it's not inevitable by a long shot, of course. But he's welcome to his opinion, I guess. Wayne Dyer. Wait, somebody's got a Wayne Dyer thing here. Wayne Dyer does some great impressions. He was great. You know, he was not particularly controversial. He was just right in that middle zone, you know, about being positive. And I remember he used to have that ball on the stage that had a light in it. He'd be like, connect to source. you know, you have to have a sense of humor with a lot of this stuff.
Well, you know, his whole thing was about, peace rallies, that those people were the least peaceful people you'd ever want to be around, you know, yeah. And that you have to embody the thing.
Oh,
you
know? Really good
you
point.
You cannot, you know, it's how you are is the way.
Thank you, Susu. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. How you are. I absolutely agree. Gray Lives Matter. That's going to take for tonight. Wow. Well, DJ's a light in the darkness. Thank you, Shane. Terrific comments. Boy, the ideas room was just exploding tonight. Fantastic crowd. And really good to see you out there. Karen Carpenter and so many great familiar faces. We will see you all next week. And another thing I want to mention is that, you know, with all the things that are going on, if we may need to do a special report sometime before next Friday. So watch out for that. We have some exciting things coming up for you this fall. Incredible docuseries, interviews, and some surprises. They'll be so off the charts. Make sure you stay right here with us on Friday nights at 8 p.m. for the X Series. Dark Journalist, we will see you all next week. You know, it says end broadcast, but you know...
Never really ends. Did you mention Ferrell's?
I did.
Okay, great.
It never really ends. Mm-hmm. And never let it be forgot. Once there was a Camelot, and there sure can be again. So I think that's what people like Kirk were trying very hard to bring about, and we share that with people like him. So, you know, these are the things we can bring about. Make no mistake about it. And we will see you all next week. Have a fantastic weekend, everyone.
Okay. Get some good sleep, some good rest. This has been a hard week. We all deserve to replenish ourselves.
That's, oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No question. That kind of psychic shock with all of it. So never let it be forgot. Once there was a Camelot.